Remember when you were a kid and you might spend the whole day with your friends just making stuff? Lego starships and castles, homemade slingshots, or maybe you were the kind of kid who liked to build your own computer or design your own computer game. Well, across the country, across the world actually, adults are rediscovering the joy of hacking and tinkering and making things, thanks to the hackerspace movement. I'm Anne Strange-Hampson. Today on 45 North, hackerspaces. They're collectively operated community workshops where the ethic is DIY, where you can learn to weld or cast iron, use a 3D printer, or build your own app. Wisconsin has a growing number of them, and today we're talking with the founders of two of them, Chris Meyer. He founded and directs Sector 67 in Madison, and James Carlson founded Milwaukee's Bucket Works, which recently celebrated its 10th anniversary, and also the School Factory, a nationwide network of hacker and maker spaces. And Chris and James, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Sure. Chris, I've heard hackerspaces called Fight Club for Nerds or Clubhouses for Inventors. How would you describe Sector 67?
The easiest way to get that out there is to think about it as a community workspace. Really, the idea is a gym club for people that like to build stuff. And so that's the easiest way to explain it.
James, how about you? You work with spaces like these all over the country.
Yeah, I'd go with the same sort of metaphor. You know, it's like a health club for your brain. You're working out your ideas. You're working out your inspirations.
Now, I've heard them called sometimes hacker spaces and sometimes maker spaces. Does it matter which term? Are there subtle differences?
I mean, there's subtle differences out there, but I mean, for anybody in the community, they're sort of synonymous. They've been traded back and forth, and it really depends on context. If you want to spend 20 minutes trying to explain what a hacker is and why it may or may not be a bad thing, depending on the context, you can run down the road of a hacker space. And if maker sounds more friendly, then you go with maker, and it just sort of depends on the context.
James, so I guess hacker has, for some people, some negative connotations?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, following major media, you read stories all the time about hackers doing things that we'd consider maybe bad. But we also see all these amazing stories about hackers doing things that are just incredibly good. So it's kind of a mixed term like many others. I like to think of these places as peer production, peers working together and collaborating in the same way.
Yeah.
Kind of cuts below the terms.
Right. Well, so Chris, if we were standing in Sector 67 right now, what would we see? I mean, what kind of tools and things do you have there?
Right now there's a non-running 1975 Volkswagen Vanagon bus that's undergoing a little bit of engine work.
And there's an entire VW bus inside your space?
Yeah, we're nice enough to have a space with two ground-level garage doors, and so we can pull cars in and out and work on a variety of different things. So we usually take car projects on a short-term basis, usually small stuff. But
and are you just rehabbing this VW bus, or are you going to do something cool to it?
It's a UW college student, and right now it just doesn't run, and he needs to get it working, so he's got some way of getting around for the summer. But we've also had a double-decker school bus. So some guys bought a school bus and drove it up here from, I think it was Arkansas. They'd bought it on eBay, and they wanted to create a mobile art incubator and kind of a studio to go tour the country with. And the cool thing about this school bus is it had two Volkswagen buses on top of it. So it was literally double-decker.
Wow. Well, that must have taken some ingenuity. What else is going on there right now?
There's usually a lot of folks in our business incubator in the morning. So the kind of the early morning crew is the folks that are there working on businesses and as entrepreneurs and consultants. We've got desks that people can rent. And then usually as the afternoon kind of kicks on, you'll get a lot of the other entrepreneurs coming in who get up a little later in the morning. And then as work gets out, you'll have a lot of folks get off work, come in and work on tinkering on their hobbies and their activities they do for enjoyment.
James, does this sound about like Bucket Works, or is I know these places are all a little different. What would we see in Bucket Works right now?
What you'd see in Bucket Works right now is very similar to Chris' description of Sector. In one sense, is a lot of entrepreneurs have probably just arrived and started work. One of the member businesses is a company called Car Care Kiosk, and they actually shoot self-fix-it videos for every make and model of car, specifically down to the exact year and model from about 1990 onward. So they're probably in their work area editing video of how to fix your own car, sort of DIY video that they share online. At the same time, on the deck at Bucket Works, the bees are waking up. There's about 80,000 bees there. We have several colonies, and they're probably
beginning the day. Insect bees?
Yes, like honeybees, yes.
Why are they there?
Well, they're part of the ecosystem.
These places just sound like, I don't... playhouses, I guess. Playhouses for really smart, creative, inventive people.
Well, you know, they're also open to anyone, especially people who are thinking, and a lot of people who are thinking, maybe I can't make things, or I don't, you know, have that spark, or I've never tried this before. You know, you don't have to know how to do everything to make use of places like these. It's also a great place to learn how. So it's a really welcoming kind of environment.
Well, Chris, that's how I first heard about Sector 67, as coworkers began coming in after weekends and saying things like, oh, I did this amazing thing this weekend. I participated in a community iron pour. And I thought, wait, what?
Yeah, we've got there's Alyssa Toninato from Feline Studios. She's a local Madison iron pouring worker, I guess. That's a bad way to explain it. But she's a cast iron metal artist. So she's making Wisconsin state skillets, as well as a lot of the Midwest, as well as the whole nation.
Oh, skillets in the shape of states?
In the shape of states. So if you want to make your Wisconsin pancakes, you can totally make Wisconsin pancakes. But so she hosts a community iron pour just before Valentine's Day. This is a second annual one here out at Sector 67 in our parking lot. And so anybody from the community can come out, carve whatever they want into a pair of hearts or into a tile, and then that's cast into cast iron forever.
Wow. Wow. So some of this sounds like the stuff that I'm old enough to have gone to school when the boys all did shop and the girls all did home ec, and the girls weren't allowed to do shop, which was completely unfair. I wanted to do shop, but it sounds a bit like, for people who missed shop or wish they'd had it, you can go and learn stuff like that.
Yeah, I have to admit, I never took a shop class in all of my primary and secondary education. This was something that kind of piqued my interest in my time away from school, you know, at home playing with cars and motorcycles and dirt bikes and that kind of stuff, and sort of never grew up from that, and so here we are today.
James, how did you get interested in hackerspaces?
Well, back in 2002, I really wanted to create a place where I could share a lot of these activities with other people. I like to do art. I like to do technology stuff. I like to do theater, music, community, all these different things. And so just found a space here in Milwaukee and began to invite other people to come in and use it. And it was an old printing factory. So there were thousands of cans of ink, millions of sheets of paper, large benches, all these accoutrements of creativity that could be turned into all sorts of useful things. So, and the joy of sharing, creating, and making with other people is just unparalleled. It's such a great experience to go through all of the concepts of both mistake making and success achievement in that whole process of creativity. It's just wonderful.
So I know that hackerspaces and makerspaces are really growing nationally. I don't know, James, you kind of keep track of those figures. How many do you think there are now?
I'd say in the United States there are probably about 300, maybe 350 functioning spaces. Many more are planned. And if you go back just to about 2007, 2008, there probably would have been maybe a dozen or a handful. So it's really picked
really
up a lot.
Oh, it's exploding. Wow. Yeah. Are you noticing that too, Chris?
Yeah, I've got, from when I had very first done some of my presentations in 2010, I took some screenshots of the nationwide and also global map of these workspaces. And then you could pick out individual points if you were zoomed all the way out to see the worldview. And now if you do that, you can't. It just looks like a sea of dots all across the Google map. So it's amazing to see the progression.
So it really is a movement. Well, what's driving it, do you think?
I think there's interest, there's genuine interest in people in kind of reconnecting with making stuff. And I really think that it's because the tool sets are getting easier. So 3 years ago when I was a college student at UW, there was a few 3D printers on all of campus. And as a student, I never had to even had a chance to look at them. And now we've got a half a dozen of them on the wall at Sector 67. And that stuff has completely changed the way to make making stuff easier.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a... I agree. I mean, the tools are easier. I think the other thing is that people are thinking differently about their work and life. And so a lot of folks at BucketWorks are, you know, they're young folks graduated from college and have, you know, a broad and deep skill sets. But instead of just going straight into, you know, work or a career, they're thinking, I'm going to take some time to build a lifestyle that involves being creative, being entrepreneurial, and kind of carving my own path. And I think some of the bigger economic things that have happened in, you know, in the nation over the last several years have told people, you know what, I better just DIY a career because I can't just trust that there'll be something in the world for me to do. And even if there is, I might not really like how it affects my health or how it affects my feeling or how it affects my inspiration. So I'm just going to choose a different path. And so we're seeing that happen a lot too.
Well, do you think there's also this sort of desire to touch stuff, to make things, has partly to do with, I don't know, is there an underlying philosophy having to do with our relationship with technology? I mean, I'm thinking, for instance, part of the hacker philosophy is that if you can't take your computer or your iPhone apart, you don't really own it, do you? You just have it on loan from Apple. So is there kind of a philosophy that underlies the hacker movement? Chris, what do you think?
I mean, there's a, to reflect directly on that, there's a website that's sprung up in the last few years called iFixit. And all they're doing is kind of like what James talked about, that they have some folks in-house doing for cars. These guys are doing it for all sorts of consumer devices. And so they'll take apart the impossible to disassemble new Apple whatever toy. They'll figure out how to be able to go in and repair it. They'll assess it and rate it on how easy it is to fix it. So that as a consumer, you can go in and think about, do I want to buy that? Because I know if it breaks, I can't fix it, or I have to pay somebody to fix it. And so I think that's something that's been really interesting to see.
So what are the coolest projects you've seen come out of hacker spaces?
Oh, that's a, I get asked that one a lot. I've never got a good answer.
Wait, you don't have a ready-made list of your top five?
Oh, I don't have a ready-made list of the top five because they're really diverse. There's so many different things that people work on that it's really hard to say, this is it, this is the crowning achievement. One of the really fun ones that I've got to watch is one of our members has a computer-controlled knitting machine. And so it's taking knitting as a hobby rather than sitting there and, you know, casting on needles for hours on end. She can make a sweater in a matter of hours and put a custom image on it or a picture or text or whatever.
Wow.
I saw the latest thing she had been working on was she made a knit of wool exports, of a map of wool exports. So she used exported wool to make a map of exported wool to explain where it comes from.
James, how about you? What are the coolest things you've seen come out of hackerspaces?
It's I share the same challenge as Chris. You know, I'll choose an example that's more of a cultural example. So a group of high school students here in Milwaukee were doing a theater show at their high school, and it was focused on gun violence. And so this was one of those approved for school consumption sort of plays. And unfortunately, they weren't able to perform the play at their school. A couple of parents got concerned about it. They said, you know, we don't know if we're comfortable with there being any discussion of gun violence at school at all. So we contacted the students and said, hey, come on over to Bucketworks and do it in our space. We'll let you use our theater and we'll let you use our space to do it. And they did. And of course, it became a much bigger deal because it was done off school. But what it led to was students from about 14 different schools around the city getting together 3 to 4 times a year to produce theater shows on topics that high school students really want to talk about but struggle to talk about at school. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a really great example, very courageous, these students coming into a, you know, semi-professional environment, learning how to run the business of theater and learning how to tackle really complex social issues that they worry about and think about a lot. And that was a really good story. Fun stuff.
We're talking about hackerspaces and the maker movement with Chris Meyer. He's the founder and director of Madison's Hackerspace, Sector 67, and James Carlson, who's the founder of Milwaukee's Bucketworks and director of the School Factory, a nationwide network of hacker and makerspaces. And we want to hear about your projects. Are you a member of a hackerspace? And if so, what have you made? What's the coolest thing you've seen come out of a hackerspace? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. 800-642-1234. You can also post on our Facebook page. It's 45 North on WPR. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Later this hour, you've heard of science cafes, but what about science beer and cheese? What unlikely pairings have to do with the future of science? But first, we're talking about the hackerspace movement with Chris Meyer and James Carlson. And we got an email from Simon who says he was co-founder of a hackerspace in New Orleans called Gumbo Labs. Love the name. He's back in Wisconsin now, and he's wondering about starting up a makerspace in Jefferson County, and he's wondering about the finances, how the finances work. Chris, you had to deal with this. You started Sector 67 just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I often get accused of cheating. I was a UW student. I competed in a bunch of business plan and invention contests for about 5 years as a student, and I was fortunate enough to win enough money through that that I was able to found the space. It took us anyways about $10,000 to get it started, and that was to kind of sign the initial lease for a year and hope that we didn't lose all of our money. And
what about all the tools? I mean, where'd you get enough money to, you know, get half a dozen 3D printers?
Begging and looking for good deals is a good way to start. A lot of the stuff we've been fortunate enough to have found good deals and things either through Craigslist or on eBay or online or in-person auctions, all sorts of things. So it just takes time.
Do you get stuff donated? I sort of remember a friend coming in and saying, wow, I was at Sector 67 the other day and some big corporation in Madison gave them these giant vats of like molten plastic or something, but it had to be used by a certain period of time before it all, I don't know, went toxic or something. Is this ringing a bell?
It's not toxic, fortunately, but we're supported by a number of companies who kind of give us surplus and scrap materials, and so we go and beg them for, oh, you guys are throwing away a whole dumpster full of plastic or metal or whatever it is. And we're fortunate enough oftentimes to get usually small quantities of stuff. Usually the amounts that industry throws away are so large, we have to say, oh, we just want a half of our truckload full. We don't want the whole dumpster. But Isthmus Engineering was nice enough to give us some of their materials. They provide us with some aluminum. And the stuff you're talking about is polyurethane resin. It's a cool casting resin we can use to make a lot of stuff.
What did you do with it?
Oh, man. There's been a lot of stuff there, too. One of the ones was giant Lego bricks, just for fun. There's a talk of making a light bright, a giant life-size light bright. We'll see if that gets off the ground. And then we also made a giant, like it kind of looks like a spray foam raft. It was like a 5 foot by 8 foot raft that went up and down the Ahar River a few times for fun. So,
wow. James, to the funding question, do you have anything to add there about how these places get started?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's fairly standard ways. What we're seeing is, usually a small group of people will come together and collaborate to make it happen. Select a location, think about where to put it, start to build up community. At the Milwaukee Makerspace, which is just down the road from Bucket Works in Bayview, they actually set up an escrow account. So founding members could put in money. And when they got the space, so before they got the space, people were sort of investing in that outcome. Then they were able to pull the funds out of that and actually trigger their lease. In general, these spaces make money and keep themselves alight from membership fees. So, you know, membership fees, people paying a monthly fee to access. Some spaces rent out space. And, you know, at Bucket Works, we've made, part of our revenue by renting out the space to different events and different groups that want to use it, which is also another great way to build up community. And as Chris mentioned, sponsorships and local businesses and manufacturing or other spaces that contribute tools, materials. I mean, it's just an endless amount of things that are being thrown away that are very valuable to us and to makers and hackers who we get all this stuff, tools, equipment, furniture. You know, literally everything in our facility in Milwaukee is, you know, either donated, found, salvaged, reclaimed, and restored to be useful to other people, all the way down to the desk chairs.
And for artists, too. I would think there's so many artists who are working with reclaimed or recycled materials these days. We've got a call from Brian in Reston, Virginia. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, wow, calling all the way from Reston, Virginia. Are you part of a makerspace?
We are part of a makerspace out here. We're part of the School Factory kind of umbrella.
Uh-huh. What's your place called?
We're called Nova Labs.
And what's the coolest thing you've seen, or what are the coolest things you've seen come out of Nova Labs?
You know, I guess as people use our laser cutter, it's really neat just to see the negatives of what's left behind, the scraps. But in some cases, you don't actually know what they're making, but the outlines are really neat. I guess the neatest thing that we've seen lately is one of our members got into 3D printing explicitly so he could actually do some projects. And so he ended up getting this group together to make the a replica of the Antikythera mechanism.
The what?
This is a 100 BC astronomical calculator that was discovered off the coast of Antikythera, one of the Greek islands. And so it basically plots the positions of planets, with our, calendar. And so this is kind of a 3D printed, gears, and everything meshes, and you turn, and it kind of has all these dials move.
Wow. I guess I'm not all that familiar with exactly what a 3D printer does. I mean, I sort of vaguely know, okay, it prints an actual object, but I don't know, what's great about a 3D printer?
Well, so you actually, think of the current printers you have in your office. They're, 2D. You end up getting a picture on a page. Think of multiple pages stacked on top of each other, and if you look at what they actually printed, and think of that as instead being plastic, you end up with an object.
It must be really hard to learn to use, because that was my other question, is can anybody just walk in and use this stuff?
Yeah, the space is open to anybody at all to be able to get in there and be able to work with a lot of the tools and stuff. There's classes and stuff that are taught, and that usually gets you up to speed in an hour or two. And then one of the other fun ones is really the 3D printing stuff, the machining, the laser cutter. All these tools have all kind of come down to a common set of either a 2D drawing called a vector graphic or a 3D file called an STL, and it's just a three-dimensional shape. So for the mechanism that he was talking about, they had to go in, they had a CT scan or a CAT scan of that device. So they have to go in, make all those gears, and then once they've got all the gears, they can print them all off, reassemble them, see if they can get it working.
Wow. That's just sort of phenomenal. So there's clearly a big educational component to all of this. And James, you mentioned working with schools. And Chris, I know Sector 67 has a whole range of classes you offer, don't you?
Yeah, there's a variety of stuff. There's a company called Fractal who's just specializing in kids' classes there. So I know there's a Minecraft class later this afternoon. So if you've got a kid who's been playing Minecraft by themselves, they can come in and learn how to collaborate with other kids and build projects and complete objectives and have some fun doing that. And yes, it's video gaming, but it's still educational. You get to learn a lot of mechanics behind it and a lot of crafting and how things are built and how to cooperate successfully.
So this is your background, you in mechanical engineering. So for I'm partly thinking that it sounds like these hackerspaces are filling a niche that the schools aren't able to fill at the moment. James, I guess you might have some thoughts about that.
No, I think it's interesting. I mean, if you look at the late 20, early 21st centuries, what's happened to schools in terms of creative classes, shop, mechanical, electrical, computer programming, kind of all these, what a lot of schools refer to as STEM activities, science, technology, engineering, math. We always put the A and call it STEAM because mm-hmm. we want the art to be in there too.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of resources for that have dwindled. And so, these community spaces often do fill a gap in that way. And what's great about it is it spans the generations. So if I'm a teenager and I go and hang out at Sector 67 or Bucketworks or Milwaukee Makerspace or Nova Labs, I get to meet all kinds of people from across the whole age spectrum who are passionate about what they're doing and who will show me how to do it. And share their projects with me. And so now I'm being brought into this environment where it's very collegial. I'm learning in a collaborative way. And it's a different model than, what we're seeing in schools. We just had a group of students come down from Manitowoc to visit Milwaukee, to visit the Makerspace, to visit Bucketworks. And these were 6th to 8th graders. And after we spent 2 hours going through both places and talking about what it is and how these places work, I said, so, do you guys want to make a place like this up in Manitowoc? And they said, yeah, of course we do. And then they started planning what building they'd use. They had to do remediation on the building, they thought, but they could ask the mayor for help. And these are 6th and 7th graders planning it. So I think if we put the tools in their hands, they will make use of it. And it's just incredible to see how kids in schools get engaged. Even the teachers actually find it liberating because they come out to places and they can do things and try things as teachers that may be a little bit difficult to do at school. Mm. And so they can do it in these places.
Chris, how did you make the transition from grad school to Sector 67 and why?
That's an interesting question. I mean, while I was a student, I had the opportunity to do a lot of business plan and invention contests at UW. And that was really inspiring to see another pathway in a career. So rather than, I graduated with a bachelor's and a master's in mechanical engineering, and I could have went off and got a job somewhere. But I thought about that, and I looked at my experiences in business formation and kind of putting my toe in the water as an entrepreneur. And I really thought the entrepreneur stuff sounds like a lot of fun. And worst case, if I fall flat on my face and it doesn't work out, I can always go get a regular job. And so it's been really fun to be able to engage with that and have the opportunity to start a business. I had worked on 4 other projects prior to that, and none of them really went anywhere. And when I graduated, I thought, I'm going to stick with this one and see where we end up.
Huh. But I would guess that as a mechanical engineer, there must have been a piece of you that, I don't know, had sort of this passion for bringing the pleasure of tinkering and working with mechanical stuff to other people.
Yeah, as a student, I always had the apartment that my friends would come over to because I had the oscilloscope or the test equipment or who knows what that they needed on the weekend because they were working on a project or something. And so we'd hang out and have a lot of fun doing that, and it sort of grew from there and grew out. So yeah, that was really the inspiration for that, is getting other people help with this stuff.
I'm going to go next to Walt, has called from Jefferson County. Hi, Walt. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, my question is about developing, how do you develop a culture of acceptance to get people over fears of, that they might have with new tools or materials or failure in front of others? How do you develop that with people?
A great question.
The easiest one is don't buy new tools. That way, if somebody breaks it, you can go, well, you know, now you get to learn how to fix it because it was old anyways, and we'll see what we can do and work your way up from that.
James?
A lot of times we'll have people doing things at BucketWorks, like making art or working with tools or equipment or electronics, but we won't tell them that it's art. So they do it, they learn it, they play with it, they make mistakes, and then we kind of come up to them and go, hey, by the way, you were just making some art there. Oh, I was? Really? It's, you know, so it's kind of, sometimes people put the blocks in up front because they've never tried it before, but if you just get them in there doing it, very quickly that goes away. And I think Chris said it right. I mean, it's when something breaks or there's a mistake, how we handle that moment is what makes it safe. And it's something that you see in these places as people celebrate the mistakes and actually use it very explicitly to learn and grow. And that's, I think, what really makes it an accepting place.
Well, don't you think that that gets to the heart of what's so appealing about these spaces? Because when we talk about tinkering, you know, or when we played as kids, that was the ethic behind it. There was no sense that you had to make something perfectly or that, you know, you were going to be paid for it. You were just mucking around with stuff. So it sounds like that's what we're sort of craving. I don't know, Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's one of the big aspects, is that just the play aspect of it is something that's rewarded in a different way. If you look at schools in a traditional system, it's usually got a curriculum with a pathway and an ultimate goal and an ultimate objective. Whereas a lot of what we're doing is placemaking. You're generating a third space people are comfortable with coming in and hanging out and just seeing what happens. We host an open monthly meeting the first Tuesday of every month. So I guess that's coming up here next week at 7 o'clock in the evening. And there's usually 30 or 40 people show up and just sit back and watch people talk about projects. And the projects, I don't know who's coming in until that night. So folks show up with something cool in tow and they go, hey, I'd love to speak for 7 minutes about autonomous helicopters or who knows what. And they'll come in and they'll drag their helicopter in and they'll talk about it a bit. And it's just amazing to see the people who didn't know anything about that perk up and go, oh, could you use that for whatever? And the presenter's going, I never even thought about that. But yeah, that'd be awesome if we could try that out and see.
So what do you do for people like me? I mean, you can probably sense I'm a little wide-eyed about all of this in the sense that I think it sounds very cool. I was a kid who grew up playing with Lego, but then there was nothing else to do after that. And I barely know how to work my computer, let alone take it apart. So what do you do with somebody like me who thinks this sounds like fun, I want to play, but I have no idea how?
The easiest one is show up for a meeting, see what things people are doing. Otherwise, show up and take a class for a night. It's usually $20 or $30 or $40. They're 2 hours long, so it's a relatively short period. So if it turns out you hate electronics or don't have any interest in 3D printing anymore, you can bug out of there after 2 hours and forget all about it. And maybe you'll find out that you're really inspired and it's really easy and you had no idea.
James, is there an on-ramp to this kind of thing?
Yeah, I think, you know, at BucketWorks, one of the things we see and also at other spaces is the popularity of meetups as a way to kind of get introduced to a lot of these topics. So, you know, at BucketWorks, there are about 11 different meetups every month, and they range. And a meetup is usually an evening gathering, about 2 hours long. Some start with beginner level skills and then progress to more advanced topics. And each meetup's usually focused on a specific thing, kind of like a class, but a little bit less structured, a little bit more social. So there's a 3D printing meetup. There's a meetup on WordPress. There's a meetup on how to hack. DC414, they have a meetup every month on how to do things like pick locks and hack into computers and actually understand how to secure your information. And these are all, as Chris said, good introductions, because you can come, meet people, dip your toes in the water, so to speak. And if you want to continue, there's a sustaining community of people who meet regularly just to learn more deeply on that topic to get connected to. And those kinds of things are really excellent on ramps. Because as you said, you come in and you take a tour and you walk around. By the time you're done, your brain will be fizzing with ideas. But where do you start and where do you get the skills? The meetups tend to be a really good way to engage with that.
Chris, what have you seen happening with kids? Have you taught a class, and how do the kids react?
The kids are amazing. It's been really fun. Our classes are open to all ages. Our general classes are. And so if you've got a kid who's really interested in electronics, they can come in and take a class with adults, and they can learn with the adults kind of at a variety of different paces and different levels. One of the other really cool programs we've got going on this summer is a summer makership program. And so it's for anybody under 18 that can apply. It's literally a page, and it's just blank. You can fill out whatever you want. But it's on our website, and it's essentially a summer scholarship for a 3-month membership, as well as $100 worth of materials or equipment or whatever the kids need to be able to build their project. And then the third thing is a mentor, which is the most important part, is finding somebody within our workspace who maybe has experience, maybe has no experience, but has interest in mentoring a kid on how to build what they want to build. And so we're taking those till June 5th. So if anybody is interested, they can go.
I want to do that. Can you offer some for middle-aged mothers? That sounds awesome. We had a Facebook message from Dustin who says he uses Bucketworks, your makerspace, James, in Milwaukee all the time. He says, I organize multiple community activities in tech, web development, including conferences and meetups. And without a place like Bucketwork, we wouldn't be able to offer the things that we do. So he says that places like this really help the community and the economy grow from the ground up. James, is that part for you, part of the vision? Is this kind of like a little alternative business movement, kind of business incubation and startup movement that's we're seeing form from the ground up?
Yes. I mean, over the last 11 years, we just turned 11 on May 22nd, we've seen 93 organizations launch out of Bucketworks, ranging from high-tech startups to high school, and even, all across the spectrum of for and nonprofit type of businesses and ideas. And the thing that they have in common is that they usually have a social innovation aspect. So there's a business that's trying to do well, as a business would, but also do good. And, entrepreneurs who are grappling with those kinds of challenges, working together, figuring out how to do good and do well, it's very powerful, and it needs help, because it's not easy to think about how to do these things. And so definitely a catalyst. It's not like a traditional incubator in the sense that when you walk in, it's not a hallway with closed doors and everybody kind of has their own little room. It's more of a reactor. There are people bouncing ideas off of each other, talking to each other about the challenges they face, filling in gaps in each other's teams and each other's skills. And all these things foment entrepreneurial activity, especially because I can try something out. I can describe an idea, get feedback immediately, maybe learn that I shouldn't try to make that into a business, fail more quickly, and thus get to a better outcome in environments like this.
Chris, it sounds to me, we haven't really talked that much directly, but it seems to me that at the heart of this movement are these kind of democratic small d values. And because most of these places are collectives and community-based, community-funded even. Am I right?
Yeah, we're sort of unusual. We're a nonprofit, and we've got a small board that runs the space. And because we sort of started from a top-down approach where I brought in the funding and was able to create it, we could kind of accelerate some of the development. But the majority of the spaces, by far and away, are all formed, as James had said earlier, by people kind of coming together, chipping in money, perhaps for nothing. Some of them pay membership prior to a space existing. And that's how they slowly can build up a pool of money to be able to start renting a space and work from there.
But is there a kind of underlying ethic that has to do with democratizing access to tools and access to knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely one of the underlying ones. Is just like my experience with 3D printing, I didn't have the opportunity in college to get access to it, so I wanted to create a space that anybody can come in and get access to it and learn how to use it and learn how to leverage it as a tool.
If we lower those barriers to entry, right? So, you know, I'm sitting around with my friends at home and I've got beer and I can talk about an idea and then not do it. And because it'd be too expensive, right? But places like Sector and Bucketworks and others, we make it so affordable, so easy to get access to these tools. Well, now you can actually try it. Just try it. We'll make it so easy. That is a big value, just making it easy for people to get to these things.
James and Chris, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure.
Chris Meyer is the founder and director of Madison's Hackerspace, Sector 67. James Carlson, founder of Milwaukee's Bucketworks and director of The School Factory, a nationwide network of hacker and maker spaces. And if you want more information about any of this, check our Facebook page. It's 45 North on WPR. I'm Ann Strangchamps, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Now, from hacking inventions to hacking the future. Today we begin the first of an occasional series, Conversations About New Directions in Science, with David Krakauer. David directs the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at the UW-Madison, and he works in evolutionary theory, computation, and complexity. Last year he was included in Wired UK's Smart List of 50 people who will change the world. And he will be bringing us from time to time interesting guests, including today world-famous physicist, cosmologist, and astrobiologist, that's a mouthful, Paul Davies. And today's topic, 21st Century Science, a story of unusual pairings. And David, speaking of unusual pairings, it looks like you brought one with you.
Yes, so We're striving for a kind of a high-low concept show. And so we'll start the show by tasting a beer, a local beer, and a local cheese. And so the sound you're about to hear is the sound of a bottle of Lake Louis Scotch Ale being opened. And we're pairing it with a cheddar, Uplands Pleasant Ridge Reserve. So the basic premise is that to make real progress now, 21st century science, we have to bring together ideas and technologies and techniques that have traditionally not been brought together.
You're saying we're in the age of scientific beer and cheese?
I think that's exactly what it is. Paul, you get to do the honors.
Thank you very much. And I recognize the taste because I had a bottle last night. The cheese, well, not bad. And the two do go together well, so we're off to a good start.
All right. So I think that I think Paul believes this, I believe this, that to do good science, we're going to have to come up with some very original ideas about new pairings.
New and strange pairings. Would you agree, Paul?
Yes, I like to see science as progressing on three frontiers, the very large, the very small, and the very complex. So we've got like cosmology, particle physics, and then this other whole sort of complex area. And most of the running in the 20th century was the large and the small. But it's very clear that the excitement now is on this edge that we call very complex, where physics, chemistry, computing, biology, nanotechnology, all of these things come together.
Well, you're kind of a living example of an unlikely pairing as an astrobiologist. This is a field that, what, surely didn't exist maybe 20 years ago.
It didn't exist when I was a student. No, that's exactly right. So astrobiology is a great case study because it brings together astronomers and biologists, but also chemists and earth scientists and physicists and even computer scientists. If you think about, is there life on Mars or Europa or something like that, we need all of those disciplines to tackle that problem. But the great thing is when you have a subject like astrobiology, more or less sort of invented as you go along, nobody expects anyone coming into that field to know all about the other things. And so I remember a discussion. There was a claim that formaldehyde had been found in the Martian atmosphere, you see, and this was been sensational because it's a possible signature of life. And we talked a bit about how reliable the claim was and so on. And this discussion went on for about 10 minutes. And then I said, what exactly is formaldehyde? and everyone was looking at everyone else. Well, it's got carbon in there somewhere and hydrogen. But, you know, nobody, we had to go to a textbook and write down the...
that's actually quite interesting. I mean, that one of the differences between physicists, at least traditionally, physicists and biologists, is this: on the one hand, biologists tend to obsess with detail, particulars, right? I mean, counting the number of hairs on a fly, or, you know, the sort of taxonomic tradition. Physicists, on the other hand, like to approximate things and think big. And that's, in fact, if there's a challenge, it's not the challenge between physics and biology. It's almost the sort of psychological challenge of someone who likes the particulars and someone who likes the general. I mean, it's a deeper problem.
There's this age-old conflict between reductionism and holism or emergence. Physicists used to be very reductionistic. You know, let's boil everything down to atoms or subatomic particles and so on. And that tradition still continues. But physicists, I think, also recognize that when you have complex systems, that you can't really understand them by chopping them up. And so the example I like to give is that no atom of my body is living, and yet I am alive. So somehow we can't capture the notion of aliveness or life at the atomic level. It's something to do with this intersection of the sciences of complexity.
David, this is your field. Do you think that too?
So I should explain. I mean, my very broadly stated, my research program is on the evolution of intelligence in the universe, right? Where it came from, how we define it, where it's going. Is there an absolute upper bound, a limit to how intelligent we will become, and how do we overcome those limits? And I would claim that we have extraordinarily powerful theories, physics theories and biology, Darwin's theory, but they're inadequate, in fact, to answer many of the questions that we ask. You know, I have a slightly unorthodox view here, so as you know, probably, and that is that I think rocks have a simple form of intelligence, very simple. I think one of the great errors in the accumulation of knowledge is our tendency to be categorical. We say things are living or non-living, intelligent, non-intelligent, and it's just, I think it's anti-scientific. I mean, I think that the cells in your body are intelligent, not the way your brain is, but if we had a really good, powerful theory of intelligence, we could measure the degree to which they were.
What's the IQ of a rock?
It's rather low, but it's not much lower than some people that I engage with.
Paul, do you think rocks have intelligence?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I'm open-minded about whether there's a continuity, for example, between the non-living and the living. Well, there's clearly a continuity, but whether it's like a phase transition, whether there's an abrupt change between non-living and living, I hope there is, because then we could understand that transition. I'm not sure about intelligence, because I can imagine that intelligence goes all the way down to zero. But there's this other thing that we're trying not to talk about, which is consciousness. And again, I could imagine that that could be like a phase transition. But I'm open-minded either way. I mean, it could be that, I'm not sure. I once talked on a TV show about could rocks be conscious, saying that I thought consciousness had something to do with complexity, but I said that, you know, some people believe that rocks are conscious. And when I saw the movie, there's just this little snippet of me saying rocks are conscious.
Well, you said it.
I'm curious, how did you both, I don't know, fall in love with science to begin with? Paul, I've heard you talk about you were the kind of little boy who...
Well, I was born a physicist, you see, so that's, that helps, so right from the earliest age. So people used to talk about having a calling in life, and it's not very fashionable to use those terms these days, but that was me. And so from the earliest age I can remember, that's what I was fascinated with. Even at the age of like 7 or 8, I read about atoms, and I looked up at the sky, and it was a wonderland. I probably didn't even know the word physics at that stage, but I was just deeply intrigued by things seen and unseen, and particularly the unseen, the idea there are fields and things that we don't notice that are all around us, just seemed very exciting. But I contrast this with my growing up in London in the immediate post-war years, where it was really, really boring. This was, people talk about austerity these days. This was a time of real austerity. We had food rationing. There were no toys. I used to make trains out of pigs all connected together. People had no money. They have cars and no television. So they had a radio. That was it. You made your own entertainment. So it was a world of make-believe. And nowadays, kids sit there, they play computer games and so on. They don't talk to each other.
Can I just wait a minute?
Yeah, you had a different...
You're being a fuddy-duddy. So wait a minute. Here's where I disagree with Paul. I don't disagree with him with what's valuable. It's just I think that that's still going on. So let me just... I also grew up in London. In fact, not far from Paul. And I grew up during the early days of personal computers, you know, the early trash 80s, TRS 80s, and Apple IIs and all that stuff. And I used to write computer games because at that time there weren't many games to buy, right? So you had to write them.
That's good. I don't disagree with that, just playing them and not ever thinking about it.
But let me just move forward. So we were doing something that, like you, in other words, playing with components, putting them together to write computer code. But I actually think we've come full circle, because I think a lot of the popular games now aren't just passive, that you actually do get to build. You build community. A lot of kids are building these amazing maps, drawing maps of these online worlds. So the better games, not the worst ones, are actually encouraging, I think, that kind of engaged building activity.
They're not just shooting each other.
I don't think they're just shooting each other, no.
Did you love science from the beginning, David?
My route was slightly different. I think it came through some of these game playing, I have to admit. Trying to understand how to make micro worlds. Mm. So when you're writing code, trying to write games, you're really trying to create a little self-consistent universe that you sort of get to preside over, right? And that, from there, there are just two fields that touch it. They abut it. One is evolution, because you say, well, how did it happen? How were worlds created on Earth? And artificial intelligence. So in that sense, it is consistent. It goes back a long way. But it wasn't really so much a sense of wonder as this sort of tinkering about with
I tinkered with things like wires and lenses and any stuff that didn't cost money that was lying around, you know, bric-a-brac, junk. And eventually I made an 8-inch telescope, ground the mirror myself in the kitchen. My mother nearly had a fit. I silvered this thing. I even, stole the chemicals from the chemistry lab. I suppose I was 16 or 17. And what you have to do, you have silver nitrate, which stains your hands black. And you have nitric acid to get rid of the grease, which stains your hands yellow. And at the end of this operation, I had these black and yellow hands, and it was the day of the school dance. And my sister said to me, "You have to wear white gloves. You can't go to the school dance like that. No girl would ever touch you."
But you see, it's interesting, because this bears on, because in a way, so you were hacking matter.
Yes.
And now we're hacking code.
We're running out of time, but I did kind of want to know, does doing science still feel like play to both of you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the most wonderful thing you could ever do. And when I talk to young people, I say, if you want a really, really thrilling career, that you may even get paid to do it, become a scientist. And actually, it doesn't matter what branch of science, because it's just great to be faced with mysteries and challenges. I love doing crosswords, for example, and it's like that. You know, nature gives you the clues, and you just want to figure out how does it all connect together. The way I like to express it is that every child will lie awake at night worrying about things like, why am I living now? Why am I me? Does space go on forever? What will happen when I die? Does time go on forever? All these things. Most people grow up and grow out of it. I never grew up. I still ask those questions. I'm still the wide-eyed school child looking in awe at the universe around me and thinking, how do I fit into this? And that's what motivates me. It's fantastic.
No, I agree with Paul. It's like this, right? I mean, people would say it's not fair, you know, Everest has been scaled. You know, they've been to the North and South Pole. What's left to discover? How do you become an explorer? And the thing about science is that everything is left to discover. I mean, the more we know, the less we know. And so that sense of a sort of a frontier that's just growing and growing, where you could genuinely make a deep, contribution and a radically new discovery. I think that fact is what makes it so compelling.
David Krakauer works in evolutionary theory, computation, and complexity, and he directs the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at the UW-Madison. Paul Davies is a physicist, cosmologist, and astrobiologist, and director of BEYOND, the Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science at Arizona State University. I'm Anne Strange-Hampson, and you're listening to 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.